Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It is Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have tons of emails and tons of YouTube comments. We're going to try to get through as many of them as we can quickly. Gabe, launch into one.
Yeah. This is from Elizabeth. I do not believe we've ever heard from her before. Hi, guys. I enjoy listening to your podcast these days. I like the little updates on what is floating around the scientific community on all kinds of topics. I recently listened to the episode on music and the question if it is getting simpler, and the artist John Denver jumped to mind. His music is very good, but simple, and he uses I a lot. Not that that's such a bad thing. He is writing what he knows. Thanks for the great soul.
Thanks for the what?
He's writing what he knows. Thanks for a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Yeah, Elizabeth, that's nice. Yeah, the research there out of Austria.
Innsbruck.
Yeah,
Innsbruck,
a Austria. Computer scientist who went through 350,000 songs and established pretty conclusively that music today is simpler.
More repetitive.
More repetitive, yeah, simpler language. Yeah. More repetitive and more focused on I or me than it was 40 years ago. Yeah. Elizabeth is saying there, 40 years ago, you also had the I and also kind of simple music, but it was still good.
Sure.
And it is good. It's just, it is getting simpler. Yeah. Major, tons of reactions all over the place to that research. A couple of them from YouTube here. One was kind of negative. It's a special kind of person who needs quote-unquote science to tell him something that is abundantly clear to anyone with more sense than a brick.
That's well, bricks have a lot of sense. I must...
Yeah, and I would say...
I'm doing a lot of brickwork lately. So.
The quote-unquote science, that was science. And the purpose... It's very useful to have your suspicions or assumptions confirmed with data so that if you get in a discussion in the future... You have data to back it up instead of it just being a suspicion. Another YouTube commenter saying that they loved AC/DC. That's the music that really makes me think. That kind of jumped out at me because I was thinking, well, actually, I listen to AC/DC a lot because at DW, we've got this little fitness room.
And that's the one CD that's in the
CD player? That doesn't jump or skip because it's been so scratched. And so I listen to it all the time. I don't know if it's that complex. In fact, I can hardly tell what's being sung because it's another person saying that there's a lot of blah 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 music out there today, but frankly these platforms have so much music on them you can definitely find really rich complex stuff. I would just repeat what Aoife told us, the researcher told us last time, which is that this may be connected to the platforms, right? These platforms sort of reward a simple catchy song. And with old CDs, you had what? You could have like three simple, easy songs, and then you could have your artistically rich, meaningful, poetic songs buried in there.
Sure. From the plethora or cornucopia of emails that we got, I got to give a shout out to Cheryl.
Cheryl.
My old friend, Cheryl Finfrock, the artist.
Yeah, she sent you. You've got her art on your wall in your home.
In my bathroom.
Yeah.
Not a day goes by, Connor Dillon, that I don't look at that art.
You don't, Gabriel Borden?
No.
Or you do? I mean, Gabriel Borden?
Yeah. Also, we haven't heard from Helbig in a long time. He reached out.
Oh, my gosh.
He thinks that Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone and Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven are great examples.
Mm-hmm.
Of music from a bygone era that was better, not as simple.
Stairway to Heaven.
I hate Led Zeppelin. I'm just going to say it right.
But musically complex, lyrically complex.
Very, very. But I just don't like Robert Plant.
Fair enough.
You know what I mean?
Okay, and I believe the last email we have time for is deeply critical of a piece of music that we played as part of that episode.
It was the ballad of the whale, the 38-year-old whale that you included.
Twain.
Generated by artificial intelligence, and that was what... this listener objected to, straight up. He or she says, "Hi, I was listening to the whale episode, super interesting. But then that AI-generated whale bluegrass ballad gave me pause.
In the azure depths where sunlight wanes, a humpback named Twain, wise and arcane."
Please consider the impact of normalizing casual use of that sort of thing. If you're going to generate an AI whale ballad, maybe...
has that sentence ever been uttered? If you're going to generate
can we be serious here? Maybe do it in conjunction with hiring a local human musician.
We're not. Look, I'm going to respond to this email straight up. I would love to have the budget to pull in a local human musician anytime we wanted for a whale ballad.
Yeah.
We don't have that budget. And so you have two options. Don't do the AI or do it. So if you don't do it, then you just have no song.
Is this something worth debating? Should we ask listeners to weigh in on this? Because I do not know the answer to it. Because it is legal. It's we can do it. Should we in future use music that's generated by AI?
Yeah.
Or does it take away from the human musicians, take opportunities away from them if this is normalized? I don't think we weren't normalizing it, right? You made fun of it.
It was bad. Yeah. It's a bad song. It did it badly, or I just didn't toggle it right. And that was it was a throwaway. And the purpose for all of you out there was to kind of make you more aware of the fact that this is like in a weird way, the quieter part of the AI revolution that's happening. Everyone focuses on the text, these large language models, or the image generation tools, and kind of forgets about the music. And it's there, and it's being used in a very big way. It's being used in mainstream songs. And that was a throwaway example to kind of remind you of that fact or alert you to that fact. We have talked on the show in the past about whether or not to use AI images. Right now, we're opting not to. What do you think? Should anyone ever use computer-generated music? Because it is, replacing something.
I'd be genuinely interested in hearing why on that one, because it's not clear to me yet. Maybe you can help make it clear to me why it's wrong to use AI to create music.
Couple science updates for you. I'll start with the one that I believe is absolutely the most important one, the most pressing. This is the spread of H5N1, otherwise known as avian flu. And I think many of you out there have probably caught some of the latest headlines. Some cows in the United States.
Texas.
Yes.
A cow in Texas infected a farmer. I understood it.
Right. And it's all kind of confusing because, avian flu, birds, right? A bird flu infecting cows?
So it's moving across several different species at this point?
And let me start with the good news because these things are always kind of scary and people float the word, next pandemic and it freaks you out. The good news is there have been people clamoring for the U.S. to please release the genomic sequences of this H5N1, this variant that's been infecting the cows and then jumped to the farmer. Mm-hmm. And they've done that. So there are now 239 genome sequences that were delivered to Gizaid, I believe is how it's pronounced. This is here in Munich, Germany. And this is where basically it's like the world's largest repository of, for example, COVID-19 variants or SARS-CoV-2 variants.
Yeah, we spoke with a researcher who's working with that project.
And so why is that important? It's important because it's basically open access to labs around the world to take a look at this stuff. And this is what ultimately leads to diagnostic tools. We all remember there was a time before swabs, those nasal swabs with COVID-19. First, we didn't have them, and then we did. That's the kind of information that leads to those, and then ultimately vaccines. H5N1 has been around for decades. I think 1997 was when it first broke out in Hong Kong. I think it's something like 18 infections and 6 fatalities. So it's been around for a while, but as we all know now, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, these viruses mutate fast, especially flu viruses. And this one, as it keeps mutating, we need to know which is the one that jumped to humans. What I'll say here is just I'll end with a quote from Daniel R. Lucy. He's the co-director of the Biohazardous Threats and Emerging Diseases at Georgetown. And he says, look, there is no H5N1 pandemic at this point, so there can be no pandemic vaccines, right? You have to have the pandemic first. However, pre-pandemic vaccines have been created. They're being refined and tested.
Already for the strain that they've... That this one is.
This is the process that has now begun. I mean, the just really quick, the back history is that this birds flew over from Europe to Newfoundland and infected some birds there. It spread down the U.S. East Coast, across the U.S. through birds.
Still through birds.
Yeah, then down the kind of the west side of South America, and there the sea lions were, I believe, eating the birds, possibly infecting each other. Sea elephants were getting involved. It began spreading across mammals and has now reached cows. Now, the cows, that is concerning, because where do cows live? They live in a place that, I mean, they're surrounded, what, by dogs, by cats, by rodents, by chickens, by birds, and pigs, which can recombine flu viruses. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of scary to have it there. On the other hand, we've had the COVID-19 pandemic. We know what we're looking for and what kind of vaccines probably need to be produced. And so people are alert to this and are watching it.
And this is typical of a zoonotic disease, that it takes this long to go through several different species before it gets to us, because that's not the way it happened with the SARS-CoV-2, right? That went straight from
the fact, question mark, to
humans.
As far as I can tell, reading from various virologists, the fact that it's jumped across so many animal species is exactly what is alarming about it.
Okay.
And that's exactly what implies that we have to be more cautious, more alert, aware of the fact that it could become transmissible between humans
with
the
future. Higher mortality rate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping our eye on that then.
Mm-hmm.
I got a quick one here. We're sitting down right now, Connor. That is not a good thing, according to this study out of the University of California, San Diego. They followed people around for 8 years and looked at how bad it is for people to sit. They equipped them with a device on their hip with machine learning. And with that machine learning, it was more accurate, the amount of time per day that these people sat. And the ones who sat for 11 hours or more, it was 30% more likely that they died after that 8-year period.
I'm just kind of stuck on the idea of people wearing a device on their hip on and off for 8 years. That's kind of crazy. Like, imagine you're on a date. Like, wait, what do you have on your hip there? Are you?
Hold on.
Did the police put that on you? Like, what?
I do not know how long they had the hip device on. That's a good point. They couldn't have had it on for the entire 8-year
period. Straight.
Maybe at different,
off and on,
different
for
times
sure.
during this 8-year period, they had the device on. 11 hours a day. That was the magic number. If you go over 11 hours, according to the data compiled by this device in this study that looked at these people for 6,489 women. Mm, that's another important thing to say. It was only women aged between 63 and 99.
Okay, older age group.
Older age group, but if you are sitting, it's more likely that you're going to die.
So the key message is stand up regularly?
Just a couple times an hour, right? And that was also important for the amount of sitting that you do. If it's longer periods of sitting, if you can break that up, let's say if you sit for 56 minutes an hour, if you split up every 10 minutes or so, just get up. Walk around, get a glass of water, get up and do anything for a little bit, and then sit back down. That is also better for your health.
One tip, concretely, that I read in the past was to avoid having a large bottle of water and instead to have a glass, because you have to get up and go refill the glass.
You have to go and fill it. Yeah.
What happened with me when I did that is I just drank less water. So it didn't work for me. But the logic there was that you would go fill it up and then you should keep drinking water, because then you have to use a restroom and then you keep moving up. You can set a timer on your watch. You can do whatever it takes. But yeah, just get up and move a little bit. I mean, it's easy to say from this perspective. I suppose when I'm 84 years old and some young buck with a microphone in front of his mouth is telling me to move, it's going to be harder to accept.
I know as a 40-year-old how hard it already is to move. So, I mean, at 84, if I'm still here, it'd be a miracle. Another real quick one. This one's out of Seoul, South Korea. Mm-hmm. Strangers have a really good sense of our well-being.
Oh, if they walk past
us. If you meet someone on the street, a stranger knows how you're doing. How well you are doing, your well-being, just by looking at you. 200 college kids had their well-being assessed. So they were asked, how you doing? And then they introduced themselves to a camera. Strangers were shown that recording.
I wondered how this...
And then the strangers were asked, is this person doing well? Their assessment of the person who was recorded, their well-being, was matched up with the person's actual assessment of their own well-being.
Uh-oh.
Almost one-to-one.
Well, I mean, I say uh-oh because I think we all like to imagine we can hide our bad days.
You can't.
If you're going for an interview or an important talk or something.
You can't. Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you satisfied with your life? Those were the questions. The people watching this 2-minute introduction were able to, almost with 100% accuracy, get that right.
Wow.
Incredible.
I mean, one question I would ask then is, can they do it with audio only? Can our listeners out there, can you tell how Gabe and I are doing today?
Would you like to introduce yourself right now for two minutes to our listeners?
Hey, everyone. My name's Connor Dillon. No, I would not. One last, speaking of, we've been talking about throwaways. This is throwaway science that popped up on one of my social media feeds. And it was a scientist who was like, hey, everyone, pay attention. We just had an audio drop. And I do pay attention to that because this is an audio show.
Well, we work in audio, yeah.
Yeah, if there's science that's
the audio's
audio
dropping, then I'm going to pick it up.
Yeah, so what was it? 34 hours of orgasms is what dropped.
Where?
In a paper titled, Why Do People Make Noises in Bed? By Andre Anakin. I think he's Swedish.
Huh.
It was published in Evolution and Human Behavior, March 2024.
Were they able to answer the question, or...?
I'll get there. Yeah. My first question is 34 hours of human orgasms. How? Where? Where do you get that? Well, it turns out that there is an orgasm sound library that exists. And I don't know how many hours total are there, but he took, let's see, 2,239 authentic sexual episodes. Almost 2,000 of those were women and about 300 male. That kind of lines up with the way that this website, whatever it is, who makes this, why, but how they describe themselves. They say, help us show the diversity of female pleasure by sharing our project. You can take part two, upload your orgasm, and they promise it's 100% totally anonymous. This is the kind of audio drop that I, you know, we try to play everything and talk about everything on the show. I went and listened to some of it. We can't put this into the show. We just can't. I don't know what the rules are, but somebody would be like, no, you overstepped what you're allowed to do. This is too much. So we're not going to play it. I just want to let people out there know that it exists. If you want to go listen to it, it's a wild ride. And what he concluded, to finish with the science here, is he says the present study was the first to perform detailed acoustic analyses of these authentic sexual episodes. And based on the evidence, I argue that human sexual vocalizations are at least partly genuine and spontaneous expressions of liking. So why do we do it? We're showing the partner, telling them, I like it, produced by men and women alike in moments of intense pleasure and presumably relying on the same neurological mechanisms as copulation calls in non-human primates. So monkeys, apes, we are accelerating the process of having a sexual encounter by arousing the partner faster, further, by making these vocalizations.
Finish up.
In a weird way, yeah. And there was one comment that I read online in connection to all of this that also put it in a different way. The commenter wrote, I wouldn't like to imagine it in dead silence. So the alternative is terrible, right? If
filling the void.
If everyone's completely quiet, that's awful. So it's good that there's some sound.
Yeah.
And again, if you want to go down that rabbit hole, there are hours and hours of that sound that people are willingly uploading themselves. I assume they're doing it with their phones.
What are the details on this? Are you going to share the link? Or
It's called Orgasm Sound Library.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those huge databases of audio that exist out there for reasons that I'm still trying to comprehend.
Our sound guy fell asleep, so we should probably stop.
I guess, yeah, this audio isn't as compelling as I thought. That's it for today. Get in touch with us. We are su@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.